All right, welcome back to Financial Survival. And no, I am not Al Dask. This is Francis Steffen sitting in for Al. We're having technical problems getting in touch with Al in Texas. So I'm sitting in for the interview with James Corbett. So I will just cut to the chase and tell you, you already know, folks, it's James Corbett from the Corbett Report. Welcome, James.
Well, thank you so much for being here. It's good to talk to you on air.
You too, James. Now, you know, a lot of the news, and this is Financial Survival, a lot of the news is about finances that we see, and China's in the front pages about a lot of stuff. What's your take on this? Now, they lowered it once, and then they lowered it again.
In fact, I believe they just lowered it for the fourth day in a row, if I'm not mistaken. Third day in a row. I'm jumping the gun on that one. But they said it was going to be a one-time event, and then the next day, I guess it was a two-time event, and then the next day it was a three-time event. So they have
third time's the charm.
Third time's the charm. You never know. Well, now it's gone down 4.65%. It's down to July 2011 numbers. This is a pretty big move on global FX markets, obviously, but I think just generally in terms of what this is going to do, what this is signaling about the Chinese economy and what this is going to do to economies around the world. And there are as many opinions on this as there are analysts. So it is a head-scratching moment. A lot of people are trying to figure out what's going on here. But I think there's definitely more to this than meets the eye. I don't think China is doing this because they want to or because they're just trying to make their exports look better. I think there's some serious structural imbalances that's going on just globally and internationally right now, and specifically with the dollar. The dollar is strengthening. The yuan is not pegged to the dollar. It's not a straight peg, but it does float within a certain range that is heavily influenced by the dollar. And that has really created a huge strain on China and other countries that have been linked to the dollar in recent years. And I think this is just some of that steam is being let off right now. And this is going to have some huge, huge knock-on effects, obviously on China's trading partners, and then secondary effects on everyone who's big trading partners with those trading partners. So I don't think any corner of the world is really going to escape what's happening right now. And it really looks like the currency war is starting off. I mean, really the only question is which central bank is going to blink first and start cutting rates and or easing. And it looks like the Bank of Japan might be the first to blink. We have Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's, one of his prime advisors, Koichi Hamada, just came out to say Japan can offset the yuan devaluation by monetary easing, of course. So the Bank of Japan looks set to turn on the printing press as a result of this. And I think that's only the first of many, many such announcements to come.
Now, when you said that, you know, they can lower rates, the United States, what are they at 0.01 or something right now? And they've been talking here about, well, you know, we're going to raise the rates here one of these days, one of these years, one of these times, but we're going to do it sometime. What has this done to that idea? I mean, is that off the table now or?
That's a good question. I think that's something that's very much in the air. There's been some jobs data that's just come out that might put a question mark over the question of whether the Fed's going to raise rates this year. And then with this devaluation, I think that has to figure into it. So people who were very sure that there was going to be a rate hike announced in the September meeting might have to think about that again. If a rate hike was announced at this time, I mean, that's just pure craziness. And the only thing that I could think of would be the people who are screaming that, you know, this September is going to be the big crash. There's a lot of momentum behind that idea right now. And they would be exactly right, I think, if the Fed announced the rate hike in their September meeting. I don't think
would pretty much do it, wouldn't it?
I can't see any way that would do anything good for the global economy, the U.S. economy, in any way. It's just insanity that they're talking about this right now. And it's almost like they want to crash the markets.
And where they're at, though, how low where they're at, what if things start going, you know, bad and, you know, without even raising the rates? I mean, they got nowhere else to go really down.
There's always negative interest rates. That's on. It's the newest idea. Yeah, we saw the Eurozone enter into negative interest rate territory in the last couple of years, and I mean, if the Fed was actually thinking about it, they could probably go the same way as well. But no, they're talking about going the exact opposite direction, and it's just
what
craziness.
What would that do? I mean, honestly, what would we kind of know what's going to happen if they do raise the rates? That's going to be catastrophe. But what if they say, well, okay, we'll go the other way. We'll just go. What's that? What does that mean to the average consumer out there? You know, the credit card owner, the mortgage holder, the regular Joe sort of guys out there. What would a negative interest rate mean to them?
Well, instead of getting money for parking your funds in a bank or a bank account or whatever, it would actually be losing money for parking your funds. So the obvious effect is to stir people into actually using their money. And that's exactly what lowering rates is all about, and that's what negative interest rates would do. It would be that incentive for people to take that money off the sidelines and put it into, well, what else? The stock market, which of course is all-time record highs. What could possibly go wrong? So we're seeing them throwing the kitchen sink at trying to get people invested in this stock market bubble, and that would be the next step.
But people would not or should not expect, if they hear negative interest rates, that that means that you're going to start getting paid to use your credit card. You're still going to be paying interest.
Oh, no. No, yeah, exactly. Of course not. Of course not in that context. But the idea would be, for example, in your bank account, instead of getting a small amount of interest deposit, you would actually get that interest taken out of your account. So that's right. That's the way that would ultimately pan out.
But
for
the
people.
Trickling down stops at the credit card.
Absolutely.
And the mortgage.
There's no way that's mortgage. Going in negative territory at all.
Yeah, okay, I see. So this is just another negative interest rates is really just theft. We're going to do a fee, is
essentially
what we're
going to
do.
We're
going to start charging fees instead of paying.
And the Keynesians, of course, would argue this is a great way to get money moving through the economy when it seems to be seizing up. And
you know, to me, it seems either they're in a jam. It seems to me that either way they go here, if they raise the interest rates, it's obvious a catastrophe. If they lower the interest rates, I don't think people are going to necessarily start using their money. I think they're going to start not using banks as much. People are going to start saying, you know what, I'm cashing my check and I'm keeping it in my pocket. I'll just live with what the inflation steals from me rather than the inflation plus, you know, the negative interest at the bank.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. This is the structural systemic problem that we're facing right now. This isn't just a problem of, oh, if they just tinker the rates in the right direction and to the right amount, it'll all be perfect. I think this is showing that there's only so much magic you can do from within the system. The fundamental system itself is going to have to come down at some point. And I think this is already being baked into the cake. But of course, the people who stand to benefit from that that collapse happening in a certain direction and then offering a certain solution will be the ones who are ready with their ready-made plan. Sure. to get us out of this. So I think we have to be very careful about that. But you're right. One of the ways this could play out is for people to realize that using these big mega banks is the problem itself. This is what underwrites and underlines the problem and makes it possible. And people trading in local community currencies and going with credit unions and getting their money out of the big banks is really the only actual solution, the only thing that's really going to work. I don't think people should be looking to the Fed to solve all of this.
And the only way it's going to happen is if they get hurt, and negative interest rates will hurt them. And, you know, so the banks are in a jam. They can't go either way. They can't go any lower. They can't go any higher. They can't. They're kind of stuck. And this is why Ponzi schemes are illegal for everybody but them, because, you know, you do it long enough and it's going to come to this problem where it's just not going to work no matter what you do anymore. And that's the whole.
That's it. Counterfeiting and all of these Ponzi schemes, all of this, all of it illegal, unless the government's doing it, in which case that's just the way it works.
Right, right. Now, I'm looking here and I'm seeing that on one thing they say, well, the federal taxes have hit a record high and, you know, we have all these problems. But then I'm looking here and it's the federal debt has apparently frozen for the last 150 days. How is that?
You know, that's a very good question. How is that?
Yeah, 150 days, that's almost 6 months. And, you know, that's half a year almost, a good part of half a year anyway. And frozen, You mean they're not spending? They're not borrowing? They haven't borrowed another dime?
Well, that clearly cannot possibly be the case. I don't know the specifics of this, but I'm going to bet my bottom dollar, as it were, that this has to do with the way that this is billed. I mean, I'm assuming that this is just that there's going to be a tidal wave of backload debt that will come in yeah. September or whenever that is. I'm just assuming it's the way that they bill this.
Well, they froze it at $18,112,000,000,000, you know,
975 million.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know what? In September, they're just going to say, oh, it's 24 trillion, you know, whatever billion. And that's that. And everybody go, oh, well, you know, I mean, we get to a no. I think we've passed the number where anybody really cares what the debt is, because I think everybody kind of realizes that. You know, even if the $18 trillion was real, which, you know, there's a lot of people out there with a lot of credible evidence, like, you know, shadow stats, a lot of credible evidence that it's far, far higher, in the hundreds of trillions. And that's not even counting any derivatives or anything like that, you know. But, you know, you get to a number where, what does it matter? I hate to sound like Hillary Clinton, but, you know, really, what does it matter? I mean, okay, $18 trillion can't be paid. Neither can $200 trillion. So, okay, so it won't get paid. Either right. one won't get paid. Right. What really difference does it make at that point? That,
well, yes, and it especially doesn't make a difference in a system where you have a central bank like the Federal Reserve that can hold U.S. government debt, and in fact, of course, the Fed is the largest holder of treasury obligations. And on top of that, the U.S. is the world reserve currency, so people are always hungry for U.S. debt anyway. So in those conditions, it really is just a number. And there's no point at which suddenly that number is going to become too high and the government can't print anymore. They can print as much as they want until people stop accepting it. So under the current paradigm, under the current regime, they could just keep printing it till the cows come home. The real question is when will people start losing confidence in that system? And we know that the Piper is playing right now, and he's going to need to be paid at a certain point. It's just a question of when that point comes.
Yeah, and they're in a jam, because there's not a lot more, you know. Well, let's just go back to the bag of tricks and, oh, wait a minute, there's nothing left in the bag of tricks. What are we going to do now kind of moment, you know, that, uh-oh, let's just see. And then you have other people, you know, players, other countries, not like China. And here's a headline from the Telegraph. And what's your take on this, and how credible is this? How real is this? How much, you know, bluster is this? Russia and NATO actively preparing for war.
I would like to see the report, but, I think we've all seen the broad strokes of that preparation for a very long time. But if they think that there's some sort of special mobilization taking place at this particular moment, I can't say that I've seen those types of moves lately. In fact, if anything, we're starting to see, for example, on the Syrian front, we've just had Putin's foreign minister Lavrov come out saying that basically Putin is trying to initiate a united front against ISIS in Syria, and it looks like there's going to be some increased military intervention in Syria this fall, with Russian support even. So, I don't know. I know that there are obviously tensions, and that NATO has been encircling Russia for a very long time, and Ukraine continues to be a boiling point. But I just haven't seen any particular moves in recent weeks or months to show that there's anything fundamentally different going on there.
Well, what I gathered from this report is basically they're just listing maneuvers and things like that, right, that both sides have been taking, and they've stepped it up a little bit in their training and their war games and their, you know, their movements along each other's, you know, like, look at us, you know, and they do that specifically. So, you know, it's for show that, look, we're ready. We're here. We're moving. We're able to move. Look, we can drive across Europe. you know, that was in the news not too long ago. The U.S. Army was making a big deal about the fact that, you know, they could actually get in trucks and drive 1,000 miles across Europe. And I don't know. I thought that was a little, yeah, so I can get my old Datsun and drive 1,000 miles across, you know, so what, you know, but they did it like it was a big deal. Like, look what we can do.
Right.
So you better be afraid. Be very afraid. We can make it 1,000 miles. And apparently from what they were saying is usually they don't do that. Usually you get in airplanes and they fly 1,000 miles and then they're where they are supposed to be and they do what they're going to do. They don't generally go over the ground. And I guess that's a skill that they thought they needed to practice a little bit. And they were very proud of themselves that they were able to accomplish it. But it's stuff like that that they're pointing to, that it appears that they're preparing for war. And apparently the Russians are doing the same thing, which, of course, they would, if they saw NATO doing that. But we're going to take a break, and we'll be back in just about 2.5-3 minutes. Everybody stay right where you're at. All right, welcome back to Financial Survival. This is Francis Steffen. I'm sitting in for Al Adask. We had some technical trouble getting in touch with Al tonight. And we have James Corbett coming to us from Japan. Welcome back, James.
Always good to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, now I asked you something during the break, and it's kind of, I don't know, this is the fluff part, okay, of the show. The politics, the campaign thing, because really half of my brain's telling me, come on, this is just a big show. The other half is going, yeah, but people are interested in it. So, James, with Hillary Clinton, the emails and all this stuff just being top secret emails now in the hands of the DOJ, boy, she's in big trouble, and the elections and Donald Trump and the third party threat. What do you think of all that?
Well,
what's your take?
For people who were thinking that Clinton Bush was going to be the 2016 election choice, it looks like Jeb Bush, it looks at this point that he's off the table. And again, you know, never write a Bush out, I suppose. Who knows how he could bounce back. But it looks like he is becoming less and less the front runner here. So the question really is Hillary. And is there any serious challenge to Hillary from within the Democratic Party at this point? Bernie Sanders, perhaps, but I can't imagine that getting a lot of play, except for within the Democrat, hardcore Democrat ranks. There might be some people who will support him, but I think just ultimately he's not going to get the funding and the financing that Hillary already has in place. So I think Hillary looks like the presumptive nominee at this point, and it's crazy to think about given the amount of political baggage she has, including, of course, the emails, which is still a developing scandal. The DOJ, as you say, investigating her servers now. It's insane that this is the front runner for the Democrat, but there you are. And unfortunately, unless anything changes in the meantime, that looks like what it's going to shape up as. So the question is on the Republican side, who's going to come out? Here's my take on this matter. Look at 92. You had Bush versus Clinton, and then you had the third-party independent billionaire who runs, splits the Republican vote, and helps get Clinton into office. The relative unknown challenger to a sitting president gets rocketed into office on the back of this, you know, split vote amongst the Republicans. Now switch to 2016, and you have Clinton versus whoever, maybe Bush, and you have this sudden rise of this guy who's already threatening to go independent, who is storming the polls, is obviously caught the public's imagination, of course, Donald Trump. And if he went third party, what would happen? There's no doubt that that would split the Republican vote. There'd be a lot of people who support him, obviously. There'd be a lot of people who want to support Republican nominee, whoever that is. And you would definitely see a Republican split vote. In that case, who would benefit the most? Obviously, the Democrat nominee, Clinton. And who does it turn out, apparently, convinced Trump to run in the first place? According to the scuttlebutt, the rumors that Bill Trump's Clinton. Trying to deny, it was Clinton. Called Bill him up and Clinton. Said, you should run. So, I don't know.
Now,
it
now
looks
let
to me
throw,
like
that,
he's
let
a
me,
ringer.
Let me throw a little monkey wrench into that. Or should I say, it's not so much of a monkey wrench as another monkey. Okay? So we have... And it does look like the Republican Party, you know, I can't imagine, okay, I cannot imagine the establishment of the Republican Party accepting Trump as their nominee. That's difficult to imagine. It's possible, but it's difficult. So he goes third party. That's an easy split to see. And as you point to 92, it's happened before. And go to the Democratic Party. What if Sanders doesn't just drop out and bow to Hillary? What if he stays in? What if he goes third party? What if he says, hey, you know what? I got a lot of support here, and I got enough money to go. In a four-way race, Hillary, Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, and whoever the Republican nominee is, what happens then?
You know, that would almost actually make this interesting. I mean, I couldn't be less interested in these kinds of presidential elections that are obviously usually decided well in advance, but I guess a four-party race would be, or four-way race would be somewhat interesting. Well, that's a good question, and I guess it's not out of the realm of possibility that we could see some sort of Democrat split.
Oh, there's O'Malley. He has been, I've read some stuff about him. He's one unhappy Democrat right now. He doesn't feel that this is...
Well, let's put it this way. I have no doubt there are a lot of Democrats who would be very unhappy with Clinton being the nominee. And so there would be, I think, some sort of support for some sort of third-party split-off candidate from the Democrats. But I don't know. I just don't know if I see the financial and institutional backing for such a run. With Trump, I mean, obviously he can finance it. And then you've got the Republican-Democrat nominee. I don't know if there's another Democrat nominee who can really put together the financing that would be necessary for a real presidential run. So
I might not be brave enough to go against the Clintons either. You can end up dead.
It's happened before. In fact, just recently.
Like 50 times before.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Clinton body count. And there may be another person to add to that. I heard just recently that one of the people who was involved in advising Clinton on Libya back when she was at the State Department just dropped dead. So who knows? Who knows?
Yeah. Oh, man. It's but it would be interesting. I would like, you know, because that would throw another aspect into it. It's like, OK, so. The radical Republicans are going to vote for the third party over here. The radical Democrats, I guess then it would just be a question of, well, how many moderate, you know, who has the more moderates? You know, who has more moderates? And, you know, I can't imagine Democrats, though, if they were given another choice. Because really up to this point, and that's what O'Malley's been saying publicly, is that up to this point, Democrats really haven't been given another choice. You know, it's like, yeah, they're out there. You know, Bernie Sanders is out there, O'Malley's out there, but really the press and really the money and all that stuff, it's just kind of because they got to have somebody to make it look real.
Right.
Exactly. They're not given another choice, and that's what he's complaining about.
Right. And of course, this feeds into, I think, the Democrat psychology generally, which is at this point almost, I think, paranoid about the fact that they may never get into office again. Will they ever have power again after what's happened with Obama? And I think they want to play it very safe. So there's a lot of Democrats who will feed into that. You know, I don't know.
And people really need to get over that, because I remember Republicans felt the same way about Bush. Oh, my gosh, after this guy, we're never going to get the White House. We're never going to get Congress. We're never going to get anything. You know, because they lost, you know, Obama got in there, they lost the House, they lost the Senate, you know, it was all Democrat control. Now look, you know, I mean, things change so much that it's crazy to sit there and think, well, just because you're having a bad day today, that you're never going to get back into office again, and oh, everybody's going to hate Democrats or Republicans forever. It never seems to last. Not very long at all. Not even a whole election cycle. It doesn't last.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know, but people are kind of funny about that. And you're right. There are the people out there that will just follow the party regardless of who it is, like the Republicans. You know, I don't think anybody has any idea. I did watch the debate, not live, but I watched it afterwards. And Jeb Bush they threw him softballs and
he got the second most amount of speaking time, despite the fact no one actually cared what he was saying. So there you go.
Yeah, he did. And hey, but at least the moderators got more time than anybody. You know, I mean, Donald Trump got 10 minutes, which was more than anybody. And each moderator got 10 minutes. And there were three of them. You know, so I guess they figured people tune in to see the moderators, not the actual.
It's team. All spectacle at this point. And
it really is.
Call me jaded, call me cynical, but honestly, I think these elections are decided by corporations and banks and financial advisors and the big money, and it's trotted out for the public. I really don't think that this is going to fundamentally change anything about the direction of the country, except on those political football issues that people can invest their identity with and get all wrapped up in. But the big policy issues and the foreign policy and financial policy is just not going to change from within the system.
I know. I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. And, you know, I can sit down and I can watch a football or basketball game and enjoy it and cheer. But, you know, I recognize it's not changing my life. Whoever wins, doesn't really matter who wins to me. You know, I mean, what does it change my life? I can take a couple hours and get excited about it, but it doesn't really make any difference in the big picture. Now, one we don't have that much time left. So let me ask you now, back to China. Given all what they've done, and who knows why, you know, who knows really what they're thinking, but what do you think their next move is going to be? What do you think they're going to do next? What can we expect next from China?
You know, honestly, I think that there's less kind of grand strategy going on here than there is kind of emergency trying to hit the panic button and do whatever they can to avoid some pretty big wheels coming off of their economy right now. And there's all sorts of signs of the economic slowdown in China, and there's just been some more data that's released, the LEAP figures, the leading economic activity pulse, down 3.9% year-on-year last month, which is down from 2.6% down in June. So definitely China is slowing down. I think this devaluation, plus the stock market crisis, plus slowing housing starts, plus slowing auto sales. I mean, there's just a real fundamental problem in the Chinese economy right now, and they're just trying to hit the panic button and do what they can. This devaluation, I think, is a corner that they've been painted into, and it doesn't necessarily help them out. One interesting part of this factor in this is that the way that they've done this is not necessarily... basically, they're reforming the way that the currency is put in that market range, where it's kind of floating in a little band. They've kind of change the rules so it floats in a different way, so it's more based on market price, which is actually perhaps one of the ways that they're trying to lobby for the IMF special drawing rights inclusion of the yuan. So basically to say, look, we're making it more based on market rates rather than our dictates at the central bank. So all of this may also be part of that ploy. But again, I don't think it's a decision they want to make. I don't think this is something they're doing as part of a grand strategy. So I think what we're seeing right now is a rearguard strategy. They're hitting panic buttons. They're just trying to stop the stock market from crashing any further. They're trying to stop the currency from getting out of control. And I don't know how much, well, obviously they have a lot of firepower left up their sleeve, but I think one of the things that we're likely to see in the coming months is that official gold holding figure to keep increasing. We know they just made a big increase in it, saying they got 600 tons in the month of June or whatever they said that it was. I think we're going to start seeing that number continuing to creep up as China just basically wants to show to the world and to their own people that they have some firepower to back it up. So I would say that's the next shoe to drop.
At what point do you think, in your opinion, do you think that what they're doing with the gold is going to catch on to the rest of the world? You know, like here in America, I mean, gosh, $1,100 spot is, you know, come on, that's so undervalued. It's a great time to buy, but with China buying all this gold, when is that going to catch on? Because everything is so much based on confidence and what people think. When do you think it's going to catch on and people are going to, oh my gosh, we need to do what they're doing? You know, we need to start buying gold, physical gold.
Yeah, well, it already is. And there's lots of different sources on this. I suggest people look it up. But basically, there's all sorts of talk from people actually in the industry, jewelers and miners and people who are saying that there is huge amounts of physical gold shortages right now. There's huge amounts of buyers for physical gold. But that's not being reflected in the price, which we know is heavily influenced by these ETFs and futures and paper gold. But we do still see some sort of market mechanism coming here. And with the Chinese yuan devaluation, we just saw gold rocket up through 1,100 and heading upwards. So even the manipulated price can only be manipulated so much and still does reflect some of these market forces. So I think people already understand that all of this rhetoric about gold being, you know, pet rocks and all of this stuff they're trying to say right now is garbage, and not a lot of people are buying it. So I think rather than looking at the spot price, I think people should be concentrating on what the actual people who are selling the gold are saying. And they're saying right, that there's huge runs on it right now, and I wouldn't doubt it.
Well, it's a great time to buy with the prices where they're at, because they're probably not going any lower, and they probably are not going to stay where they're at very much longer. Hey, James, give everybody your contact information. How can they get the information that you write about and all the places that you write?
Go to CorbettReport.com, CorbettReport.com. All of my information is there. All of my videos, interviews, articles, podcasts, thousands and thousands of hours of media free for download. And of course, I also write the weekly, bi-weekly editorial in the International Forecaster. People can get a free copy of that at TheInternationalForecaster.com. And you can also subscribe there and get 40 pages of really quite interesting and vital market information twice a week. So I hope people will go there and check it out.
Well, that's great, James. Well, thanks for being on. It was a pleasure to interview you. I hope someday I'll get a chance to do it again, but probably next week Al will be back in the saddle. Thanks for being on. Folks, thank you for listening to Financial Survival. And, thanks for listening.